Hello, undisclosed listeners. We've got three great sponsors this week. First up is ABC's debuting drama, Conviction. It comes out this Monday, October 2nd. Make sure you don't miss it. Stamps.com. Thanks again, Stamps, for coming back. And our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. Make sure you listen in for the spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the show.
Last week, we looked at Joey's prior difficulties with Isaac, according to the state, at least. This week, we look at how Tammy Colston, the prosecutor, widened the net, pulling together a list of all the times she alleged Joey got into altercations with others over a girl. Because when you don't have real evidence, the best you can do is convince the jury your defendant is simply a bad person. Hi and welcome to episode 11 of Undisclosed. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney, a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and the author of Adnan's Story.
My name is Susan Simpson, and I'm an associate at the Volkov Law Group.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I am an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Last week, we talked about the state's claims concerning Joey's alleged prior difficulties with Isaac Dawkins. Because the state didn't have much in the way of evidence about things Joey had done to Isaac, the bulk of the state's case instead focused on things Joey had supposedly done to other people. Joey was always trying to fight Breanne's other boyfriends, prosecutor Tammy Colston claimed in closing arguments. Therefore, we can assume he was trying to fight Isaac, too.
Now, what truths do we know about this case? Let's start there. What can we definitely say we know about this case? First of all, we know beyond any doubt whatsoever that Joey Watkins hated, despised Isaac Dawkins. We agree on that, no doubt about it. He hated him because he had taken his precious Breanne. He hated everybody that took Breanne. You heard the evidence as to what he did with Breanne's other boyfriends. It was a pattern, it was a course of conduct. He would threaten and intimidate and harass those people who dared to date Breanne. He did the same thing with Isaac Dawkins he did with the others. What's that? With another traitor truth? That he did stalk, harass, intimidate, and threaten Isaac Dawkins.
In other words, Joey's fundamental character involved an obsessive, murderous hate of anyone who dated Breanne. And if one of Breanne's boyfriends was killed, it can safely be assumed that Joey was the murderer.
The prosecution, however, faced a hurdle in seeking to introduce this evidence of how Joey acted in other situations. And that hurdle can be traced all the way back to common law England. In England, prior to the 17th century, courts admitted almost any type of evidence, with the only limitation being rules deeming certain categories of individuals, such as atheists, incompetent to testify at trial. All other forms of evidence were admissible under the inquisitorial system, which had reigned in England since the Norman Conquest, and which found an evidentiary code unnecessary. Under this system, it was not considered irregular to call witnesses to prove a prisoner's bad character in order to raise the presumption of his guilt. This open-door policy with regard to propensity character evidence could be explained by the inquisitorial system's assumption that the accused committed a crime and the concomitant requirement that he affirmatively prove his innocence. One of the most conspicuous consumers of propensity character evidence, and ultimately the cause of its death, was the Court of the Star Chamber. Established in 1487, the Star Chamber conducted treason trials, but it was really a way for the Tudors and Stuarts to dispose of political and religious dissenters of the monarchy. The Star Chamber was the Crown's organ of terror, renowned among the citizenry for its arbitrary and cruel decisions, and one of its most capricious practices was the deluge of character evidence it admitted, resulting in defendants being punished for their sordid character rather than their culpable conduct. The Star Chamber engendered widespread animosity in the citizenry in the years preceding the English Civil War, eventually prompting the Revolutionary Long Parliament to abolish it in 1641. At the close of that Civil War, the Restoration, and the Glorious Revolution, those same dissidents who were subjected to the monarchy's organ of terror had wrested control of the Parliament, but still felt the sting of the Star Chamber. In an effort to prevent the ills of the past from infecting the future, these new power wielders passed the Treason Act of 1695, which contained a provision proscribing prosecutors from proving at trial any overt acts by the defendant which were not charged in the indictment, thus precluding the admission of propensity character evidence. And while this restriction was initially limited to treason trials, it soon permeated all criminal trials, with courts and commentators recognizing that the use of such character evidence violated the right to due process of law guaranteed by the Magna Carta.
prohibition on the admission of character evidence soon carried itself across the pond, with the Supreme Court describing the reasoning in an 1892 opinion in Boyd v. United States. Proof of prior bad acts only tended to prejudice the defendants with the jurors, to draw their minds away from the real issue, and to produce the impression that they were wretches whose lives were of no value to the community, and who were not entitled to the full benefit of the rules prescribed by law for the trial of human beings charged with crime involving the punishment of death. However depraved in character, and however full of crime their past lives may have been, the defendants were entitled to be tried upon competent evidence, and only for the offense charged.
Under Georgia law in 2001, character evidence was prohibited, with one tiny little exception that, in practice, threatened to swallow the rule whole. The statute read, "The general character of the parties, and especially their conduct in other transactions, are a relevant matter unless the nature of the actions involves such character and renders necessary or proper the investigation of such conduct." Or, to put it another way, character evidence is prohibited if it boils down to nothing more than once a criminal, always a criminal. So the state couldn't, say, present evidence that a defendant on trial for robbery had committed a prior robbery just to prove that he robbed once, so he probably robbed again here. Or they couldn't call a witness in an aggravated assault case to testify that the defendant had a reputation for being violent, for the purpose of proving that the defendant just tended to be violent in general. So it's totally plausible that he would have been also violent here. But then there's that tiny little exception I mentioned, the one based on modus operandi, or MO. That's a Latin phrase that roughly translates as method of operation, and in Georgia, the courts call this course of conduct, bent of mind, or identity exception. According to Colby State from the Georgia Court of Appeals, a much greater degree of similarity between the charged crime and the uncharged crime is required when the evidence of the other crime is introduced to prove identity than when it is introduced to prove a state of mind. Much more is demanded than the mere repeated commission of crimes of the same class, such as repeated murders, robberies, or rapes. The pattern and characteristics of the crimes must be so unusual and distinctive as to be like a signature. A defendant's sole prior act of armed robbery would not be so nearly identical in method so as to earmark both the prior act and this offense as the handiwork of the accused. Nor is it in the nature of a signature, and thus is some evidence of the identity of the perpetrator.
Now, this so-called signature can be a literal signature, like Zorro leaving behind the mark with a Z, or the kitchen sink burglars in Home Alone putting towels in kitchen sinks and leaving the water running in the victims' homes to flood them. Or in other cases, the signature can involve the crime itself, such as when serial arsonist Thomas Sweat started all of his fires by filling a milk jug with gasoline, plugging the opening with a piece of clothing that served as a wick, and having the wick burn plastic for more than 20 minutes before the fire consumed the container, leading to gas fumes escaping and eventually catching fire. In either case, though, the purpose of this exception is not to prove the defendant committed the crime at issue. That, of course, would be impermissible character evidence. The point is to prove that this crime and the prior crimes are so distinctive and so unique that no one else could have committed them. That said, and this gets to Susan's issue, the problem is that this distinction has become far too fuzzy. As Justice Sears noted in his special concurrence in the opinion of the Supreme Court of Georgia in Farley v. State, bent of mind and course of conduct have evolved into amorphous catchphrases, difficult to define and slippery in application. While they may be legitimate purposes for introducing independent crime evidence under some circumstances, careful analysis of the relevance of the evidence is especially important when those purposes are claimed. Such careful scrutiny is essential because a person's bent of mind is dangerously close to being his character, and a person's course of conduct could easily show nothing more than a mere propensity to act in a certain manner. New crime drama is coming to ABC on Monday nights this fall called Conviction that looks at the American justice system in a unique way. What makes the show different is that while most crime stories end behind bars, that's exactly where Conviction begins. Each year, over 10,000 people in America are wrongfully convicted. And as undisclosed listeners know, they could be the victims of mistaken identity, forensic errors, mishandled or tampered evidence, false confessions, police corruption, and more. Inspired by real-life conviction integrity units that have been formed across the country, the team's purpose is to investigate potential wrongful convictions. The team on Conviction doesn't put people in prison. Their job is to help free the wrongfully convicted. The show stars Haley Atwell, who is simply amazing as Agent Carter in both the Captain America movies and her own TV show, and she's the leader of the unit. She plays former president's daughter Hayes Morrison, who has her brilliant legal mind but her own baggage that makes her pretty well suited to providing second chances for the possibly wrongfully incarcerated. The show also co-stars Emily Kinney, who is so good as Beth in The Walking Dead. And I can say from watching the pilot that both do a really good job of establishing their characters in the first episode, and it seems pretty clear this is going to be a show that's faithful to the actual work of conviction integrity units rather than being a show of spot the legal error. The show is created by Liz Friedman and Liz Friedlander, who've worked on shows like House and Jessica Jones, and it's executive produced by Mark Gordon, who's produced movies like A Simple Plan and Source Code and TV shows like Criminal Minds. Conviction premieres on ABC's Mondays this fall at 10, 9 Central, starting on October 3rd after Dancing with the Stars.
Georgia has a procedure set up when the prosecution wants to admit character evidence under this exception, and it requires the prosecution to serve notice on the defendant using something called a notice of prosecution's intent to present evidence of similar transactions, followed by a hearing before the court to determine admissibility.
This similar transaction evidence would be a big deal at Joey's trial. In fact, it was kind of the only deal, not counting Mullinex, for whatever his testimony may have been worth. The prosecution didn't really have anything in the way of direct evidence linking Joey to the murder. So instead, the majority of the state's case was spent discussing things that had absolutely nothing to do with the murder, or even with Isaac. And often, they didn't even involve Brianne either. Instead, the state tried to admit as many examples as it could possibly shoehorn in against Joey, to show he was a jerk in some fashion, no matter how far removed that incident may have been from the charges actually laid against him. And, unfortunately for Joey, his prior history gave the prosecution a lot of places to start.
I was listening to Claire's interview with Delane, and he mentions that you had a reputation. You wouldn't win every fight, but you'd still fight.
Yeah, that's true. You know, that was me. I didn't care who it was. I would fight, you know.
Was it usually over Brianne or just anything?
Oh, not all of it was over Brianne. A lot of it was over my sister, my younger sister. And they used a lot of that in my trial and called it similar transaction.
I've seen that. So I've been going through and trying to track down all the documentaries, like all the documents we have for each issue and trying to figure out what the background is for each example in that notice. And it's a... there's probably 14 stories listed on that sheet, and for each one, there's 5 different versions of it. And trying to piece together each one has been kind of a pain in the butt.
Yeah. I don't know what else to... A lot of this confused me, you know? I heard so many stories when I was at trial. It's like, what? When did I do that? You know, when did this happen? And it's like, I don't know.
Joey's confusion about the witnesses at his trial and what they were saying was undoubtedly due in part to the fact that the state's similar transaction notice is itself a hodgepodge mess of some totally fabricated claims, a few actual events that were rendered nearly unrecognizable by the way Colston presented them, and also a hefty dose of nonsense that I can only assume Colston borrowed from the local rumor mill, because no witness that I've ever come across or read about ever said them. This notice was filed by Prosecutor Tammy Colston on June 13, 2001. That's only 12 days before Joey's trial. By that point, it was way too late for Joey to raise an adequate defense to it, because there is no way on earth that even the most competent counsel could have possibly deciphered this disaster of a document, especially not in 12 days while also preparing for trial. This notice included, in addition to the 6 incidents of prior difficulties that we discussed last week that involved our purportedly involved Isaac, also had 14 similar transactions that involved Joey's interactions with people other than Isaac. These incidents were supposedly admissible evidence that Joey was the person who killed Isaac Dawkins, but many of them are so disconnected from anything having to do with Isaac's death that it's hard to see why they were chosen except for the fact that they made Joey look really bad.
Yeah, and understandably, the defense in this case wanted a full-blown evidentiary hearing where we could have these witnesses be cross-examined, determine what they would say, as opposed to just relying upon the word of the prosecutor in the case. But that ultimately was unsuccessful. So here's the exchange between the judge in the case, Judge Matthews, and defense attorney Rex Abernathy. Mr. Abernathy, of course, our position is judge stating in her place what that evidence is won't do it. We're entitled to a hearing to cross-examine witnesses. The response by the judge, no, you're not. Mr. Abernathy, that's the issue. The judge, you're not entitled to a full-blown hearing. In fact, the Supreme Court has been very clear. I can hear statements in counsel's place, including yours, as to what evidence would be produced with respect to those incidents in order to determine whether or not they fit the standard of similar transactions.
Judge Matthews was right. In Georgia, the prosecutor can just describe the character evidence that's going to be presented rather than having to call the character witness and have them exposed to cross-examination. It's different, though, from whether Georgia's policy makes sense. In Meyer v. State, the defendant appealed his conviction, complaining that the trial court erred in failing to conduct an evidentiary hearing on the admissibility of the similar transactions, rather than relying on the assistant district attorney's statements in his place as to what the similar transaction evidence would show. He maintains that the proffer of evidence of the transactions was dramatically different than the actual trial testimony of the prior acts. But the Court of Appeals of Georgia disagreed, concluding that any eventual disparity between the stated expected evidence and the actual testimony has not been shown to have been known or anticipated by the state at the time of the hearing in the matter. But isn't that the whole point of requiring the character witness to testify in front of the judge before he testifies in front of the jury? Under Georgia's procedure, a judge has to approve the admission of character evidence without the judge, defense counsel, or even the prosecutor having a good idea of what the character witness is actually going to say.
And see, Robbie, you say even the prosecutor, but in this case, it's clear that not just the defense counsel, but also the judge seemed to have a better idea of what was going on than Tammy Colston did, because she misrepresents the facts in just about every single one of her points. And at one point, the judge even breaks in and says, well, look, these kids were having all kinds of drama with each other. They were, you know, going out and fussing all the time. How is this even really directly related to Isaac's death? And she comes up with reasons or claims about what her witnesses are going to say. But a lot of the time, she's just dead wrong. That's not what her witnesses are going to say. It's not what they've ever said before. And I'm not even sure where she got those ideas from.
Yeah, I have a huge problem with Georgia's system here for exactly that reason. Is it's just relying upon the word of the prosecutor. And A, the prosecutor could be acting in bad faith, but B, it's also quite possible that the prosecutor unknowingly is, whether slightly or significantly, misrepresenting what these witnesses are going to say. And that's the whole point of screening this, to say, look, this is character evidence that could be hugely relevant to the jury convicting, and you need to make sure it is reliable and that this witness, in fact, is going to say what you claim he's going to say. And that's, as we'll see, one of the big problems in this case is oftentimes it didn't match up to what Tammy Colston said.
It almost seems like there's no remedy in this case where the prosecutor can make whatever proffer they want. This is what the witness is going to say. And the witness can say whatever they want, totally different and contradictory to what the prosecutor has said. But oh well, like there just seems to be no way around it.
I mean, that's the whole point. Like, okay, let's be real. The reason the prosecutors want this in, at least in a case like this, is not because it shows a signature for a crime. They want it in for one reason, which is to make the defendant look bad. That's what they're doing. I mean, that's fine. Under the current system, they can do that. But that is their goal. So for them, for their purposes, it doesn't matter at all if the witness is going to testify to something slightly different what's been proffered. As long as the general gist is right, it's still something that makes the defendant look bad. And in this case, I really don't know what was going on. I mean, apparently, Colston needed to like borrow our relationship chart because she could not keep straight who was dating who or who should have been jealous of who. So there's all these claims about how Joey was acting out of jealousy for people that had definitely never dated Brianne ever. Anyway, let's go on to those 14 supposed prior transactions. First, we'll discuss the Christmas Eve incident. Colson's proffer reads, on Christmas Eve of 1999, Chad Redden was at the Mount Berry Square Mall with Breanne Scarber. Chad and Breanne were dating. Joey Watkins tried to get Chad Redden to fight him because he was dating Breanne. Breanne Scarber tried to intervene, and Joey Watkins punched her in the ribs.
Now, you might recall that we previously discussed this incident in Episode 3 and how a neutral witness at the scene said they didn't see any of what Breanne described. It is true there was an event that happened on Christmas Eve, but Breanne waited until January 13th to get a warrant for Joey's arrest for battery, and the fact that Breanne waited until the day after Isaac's death to take action in regard to this altercation doesn't seem like a coincidence, and Joey himself doesn't seem to think so either.
It's a... You can tell that in the days after Isaac's death, I mean, Breanne's the one who chose that moment to go and file that charge against you and get you locked up on the 13th.
It's just...
And you can see that they were... Yeah.
They were at me. It was a setup, man. I swear it was a setup. And I know it sounds like... It was like the perfect time to strike at me type deal, you know?
In fact, it appears that Breanne began talking about her plans to have Joey arrested even before Isaac had died. Detective Moser's notes from January 12th indicate that he spoke to Melinda Lewis, who had information from Breanne about how they were, quote, going to go before the magistrate court on January 13th, which would seem to be a reference to the warrant she in fact took out that day.
And that brings us to the next incident. Of all the similar transactions that Colston compiled for her notice, exactly one of them involves the type of transaction that Colston has proposed to be similar to Isaac's death. Joey having a physical altercation with another guy due to his jealousy over that guy's involvement with Breanne. And something like what was proposed in Colston's notice actually did occur. However, Colston's version of the event has next to nothing in common with the actual event. Here's what the notice says. In early 1999 or late 1998, Joey Watkins pulled a gun on Delaine Roach because Delaine had a date with Breanne Scarborough. Joey Watkins saw Delaine Roach and Breanne Scarborough at the movies at Mount Berry Square Mall, and he laid a .30-06 rifle across the hood of his vehicle and threatened to kill Delaine. Now, you might remember Delaine from Episode 3 and his discussion of the bowling alley incident. Delaine was a guy that Joey had clashed with because he was dating Breanne, although the two of them became close friends shortly thereafter. And there was a fight, well, sort of, between the two of them at the movie theater while Delaine was on a date with Breanne, but this whole event never comes up at trial at all. Even though it's the only legitimate instance out of all of her similar transactions that involves Joey starting a fight because of his jealousy over Breanne. So why not? Because Colston's witnesses told such fabricated version of the story that the whole thing fell apart.
The story started off simple. Adam is the first one who ever brings it up in March of 2000, and he tells Sutton that Breanne and Delaine were on a double date with Chad and Tandy, that's Joey's sister and her boyfriend at the time. That's the same Chad that would later be dating Breanne at the time of the Christmas Eve incident. And while they were out on this double date, Joey showed up and pulled a gun on Delaine. But then in October, when Sutton did a recorded interview with Adam, Adam pulled a J and just started throwing all kinds of crazy details into the story, trying to make up for the fact he can't actually recall what he's supposed to be saying.
I was with Courtney Moore, a girl I dated, and she had to be home in an hour, and he told me that, he said, won't you just go with me? He said, and I'll take you back to her house and get your truck later. I said, well, that's fine. He went with me, or I went with him, excuse me. Well, after then, we rode around for a little while looking for him, and he remembered Tandy and Chad was going to the movies out there beside the mall, and he said, we're going to ride after. He said, I got this feeling. Well, we rode out there. Sure enough, we sat there 15, 20 minutes. Here come Tandy, Chad, Delaine, Brian, right in the back seat of Chad's Blazer. Joe is saying, oh, I'm going to whoop his ass. I'm going to whoop him. He said, you going to back me up? Chad jumps in. I said, man, Chad ain't going to jump in. Chad don't care. Well, he got out, proceeded over to Chad's car, jerked the car door open, grabbed Delaine and started trying to punch at him. Delaine was kicking at him, and they ripped the back of Chad's seat. Chad was hollering. Joey grabbed Chad and slammed him up against Tandy over in the passenger seat, started hollering, get out, get out. And I'd had a few drinks that night, me and Courtney. I'd had a few drinks that night, and I didn't want to get in trouble with the law. I didn't want to meet up with him or nothing. Tried to get him back in the car, and he had his 30-06 laying in the seat.
Who did?
Joey.
30-06 rifle?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And he run back to the truck. Delaney said, let me go call my boys. Well, he went and called Jamie Chastain and a bunch of black boys. Delaney.
Okay.
Called a bunch of black boys along with Jamie Chastain.
Uh-huh.
Well, they come riding up there in a little two-door Camaro, about an 80 model. And they jumped out with baseball bats and run Joey back to his truck. Well, Joey got in his truck. He tried to run over one of them, and I think that was Jamie. He was the first one standing out in the road with the baseball bat. Joey backed up as far as he could and got his rifle out and just laid it over the hood and said, I'll kill all y'all, this, that, and the other.
Was he cussing?
Yeah, he was cussing, raising Cain. Jamie said, put that gun down, come on, come on. Joey said, oh, y'all got bats, and I was screaming for him to get in the car. I just know they was fitting to kill us with baseball bats.
Did he pull the gun on all of them, Delaney Roach and others?
No, not Delaney. Delaney had done walked in the movie theater by this time.
Of course, Adam doesn't even remember that this story is supposed to involve Joey pulling a gun on Delaney. Because this taped interview was from December of 2000. And Adam's original statement to Sutton, the one that first brought up this incident, was done sometime back in March. And it did include threatening Delaney. In the December interview, Sutton gently tried to correct Adam before abandoning the attempt when Adam went off script and failed to mention the gun being pulled on Delaney. Because in April, Sutton interviewed Chad Redden, and here's what he recalled about the incident. Once again, I apologize for the poor quality of this clip, but here's a segment of that interview.
Now, I ain't talking with another guy, Adam Elroy, and you're dealing with these guys and you wouldn't need to Joy Watkins pulling the gun on Redden on Delaney Roach. Were you there?
Yes, sir.
Tell me about that. We were at the movies and Brianne had went on a date with Delaney and Joey come up there, was mad about it. Then Brianne Scarborough, Joey's ex-girlfriend, and he laid a 30-06 across the hood and threatened to kill Delaney.
Delaney knew Roach.
Because of what reason?
Because of Brianne.
Because Delaney had dated Brianne?
They went to the movies one night and that was it.
Where did this take place at?
At Mount Bear Square Movies.
And how long ago did this happen?
About a year and a half, 2 years ago.
And according to Chad, there were no baseball bats involved at all. But there was a 30-06, and it was Delaney, not Delaney's friends, that Joey threatened with it. Then we get to Delaney, the guy Joey supposedly, pulled a gun on. Here's what he says happened.
This right here was strange to me, but Brianne and Tandy were friends. And I guess they thought it was a good idea when Joey and Brianne separated one time to hook Brianne and myself up, hook us up on a date. You know, that was kind of strange to me because I'm actually going to their house to meet Brianne. And, you know, I asked them, you know, is Joey going to be okay with this? They said, oh, he doesn't care. Now, at that age, if I would have had a girlfriend and that same situation would have taken place, I would have been livid.
Mm.
You coming to my house? And that's kind of the direction it took. I didn't know, you know, how Joey felt about Brianne. I just knew they dated. It wasn't explained to me. Brianne was an attractive girl. And we all set up a night to go out at the movies.
What happened at the movies?
I rode with Tandy and Chad to the movies. And at that time, you know, I carried myself as a guy who could handle his own. And, you know, I wanted to be known as a tough guy. But, we pulled up at the movies, and I honestly felt like Chad had set me up, because as soon as we pulled in the parking lot, Joey and his buddies were there. Oh, I forgot to mention, you know, I was kind of skeptical that night of, you know, because Joey and I had already had words like a day or two before the movies, but I still was going to go out with her to the movies. We had this planned all week, and you know, just thinking through the whole thing, But I called a friend of mine.
Jamie Chastain.
Yeah, I called Jamie and his girlfriend, and which in turn he called a friend of his and their girlfriend. So there was
a lot of people.
There's a lot of people there. You know, that's really how Rome's always worked in situations like that. But it didn't all come together at a head, you know. We pulled up, and my friend Jamie and his girlfriend and the other two were parking. And as I was getting out of the back of Chad's Blazer, Joey run up on me. And Joey and I scuffled around a little bit, and Joey took off, jumped in his truck. And, you know, here come my friends, here comes Joey's friends. But, you know, in the end, I think it was Joey and his friends weren't aware that I was going to have some friends with me as well. Mm. And nor did Chad know, because I didn't tell Chad or Tandy. But that was kind of the climax of everything that night.
You never saw a gun?
No.
Did Joey take a gun, hunting rifle out of his truck and put it on the hood of a car and threaten to kill people?
That night, no, there was never anything like that.
When Claire asked Delane about what he'd meant about thinking Chad set him up that night, Delane explained he thought someone had tipped Joey off about the date, that someone had told Joey Delane would be there because they wanted to see the fight happen.
I thought Chad had told Joey. Chad was fearful. You know, whether he'll admit it or not, Chad's just scared. He's not a real stand-up guy. He's a great person. He's not a stand-up guy. He'll let people push him over. And like I said, I was in the back of a Blazer. And I saw Joey. I saw them pull up. And I was like, let me out, let me out, let me out. It's a two-door Blazer. I'm in the back. The Blazer seats have to push forward and then you get out. It's mm-hmm. a tight fit. And when I kept hollering, let me out, let me out. Chad wouldn't open up the door, but when Joey come over there, Chad opened up the door. And it was like, I felt like Chad was trying to let Joey, you know, get to me first. But actually, it worked on my behalf, because when Joey actually leaned in the Blazer, I kicked him in the shoulder and on the neck or something. And it kind of knocked him backwards, and I was able to get out then. But yeah, I felt a little betrayed, but I didn't know. I wasn't thinking of it like I would now.
As to where this whole story about Joey pulling a gun on him came from, well, Delane doesn't know, but he has a guess.
Like I said, it's 16 years ago. It's hard to remember everything day by day, but I remember, you know, certain events, you know, the movies. You're going to remember that.
Mm-hmm. But there was no gun that time.
Uh-uh.
So Adam Elrod saying that Joey laid a gun on the car and threatened you with it, where's that coming from? Do you know?
I don't know. I guess him just wanting to be a part of everything, maybe. Mm-hmm. He wasn't there. People want to be a part of stuff so they can have stories to tell. Hey, remember when this happened and da, 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 and make it worse than it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you're fearful of something, you say, you know, you and your buddies go over here to a fight and there's really four people against two, but tomorrow it was just two of us and there was 20 of them.
Ultimately, this event did not come in at trial, although it's not clear why. The judge was going to allow it in on the basis of Colston's inaccurate proffer that Delane had denied a gun was involved, but had conceded Joey had used a baseball bat, something Delane also says never happened.
And that's another example of areas where Tammy Colston's proffer and the hearing concerning the notice of intent to raise similar transaction evidence didn't match reality, because there isn't any statement where Delane has said that baseball bats were used. In fact, the only person who remembers baseball bats is Adam Elrod. But she got these mixed up in her head, and on that basis of her presentation to the court, it seemed like a more plausible, I guess, or a more relevant example of Joey's violence. But it's also not true.
Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. Today, I want to focus on the farms. Blue Apron has direct relationships with farmers who engage in regenerative farming practices. Through their direct relationships with farmers, they're able to send their home chefs produce at peak freshness with minimal time in transit and at a better value than they can find at their local grocery store. These direct relationships also provide their farmers with guaranteed demand for their harvests, allowing them to better plan their crop rotations to grow specialty produce just for us and improving their livelihoods in the process. So Underscores listeners, you can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. That's the same code as season one. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Again, that's the same code as season one. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Now, of the four people that Tammy Colson named as witness to this incident, only Delaine agreed to speak to us. Adam Elrod, Breanne Scarborough, and Chad Redden have all declined to speak to us, so we don't know what they have to say about this incident. There was one other witness, though, who was not named on Colson's notice. Tandy, Joey's sister.
I asked her if she could ever recall there being a fight between some guys at the Mount Berry Square Mall parking lot. And she did remember one fight, one actual fight that happened there, one time between Chad, who was her boyfriend then, and Josh Flemister, another guy they knew. But although she recalled kind of what this incident was about, all she could really remember about the incident was that Delaine and Joey had squared off, but a fist fight had never really materialized. Although she did recall seeing Jamie Chastain there for some reason. She wasn't sure why she kept thinking that. But she also confirmed what Delaine had said about them insisting that Joey wouldn't mind if he dated Breanne.
I remember Joey and Delaine almost getting in a fight. They exchanged words, but I don't remember anything like huge happening. You know, nobody actually got in a fist fight, but it was just like people running their mouths back and forth to each other.
So I was going through Delaine's interviews, and part of what I was confused about is that he was saying that he knew that Joey was going, well, actually, he kind of blames you a little bit. He's not
blame me.
He says that you encouraged him to date Breanne and insisted that Joey.
You know what? I told him, I was like, listen, because, you know, me and Breanne were best friends before she ever dated my brother. Like, when she started dating Joey, I was like, ew, you're dating my brother? You know what I mean? It was like, she was my best friend. When her and Joey would break up, she would still be at my house because me and her were best friends, right? Mm-hmm. And Delaney was like, no, I don't want to start any trouble. And I was always like, no, it's fine. Everybody's cool with everything. I tried to, like, keep the peace, you know? I was like, everybody's good. Nobody's going to have a problem with it. I swear, it's okay, you know? So, you know, I tried to kind of, you know, make it not such a big deal. So, yeah, I could see that.
I also talked to Joey about it, and his version is pretty much the same as Delaine's and Tandy's versions. And he was also able to confirm Delaine's theory about what had actually happened leading up to this whole thing.
How'd you know he was there?
Chad?
Chad told you?
Yeah.
So Delaine's right. I was listening to Delaine's interview, and he says that he thought Chad set him up that night.
Chad, yeah, Chad did set him up. Chad called me, and it was like, hey, look, we're going to be at the movie theater, and they're lying to you. Brian's lying to you. You need to show up at the movies. And so I did. Me and it was me and Mark Free.
It was Mark. Okay.
Yeah.
So apparently Delaine was a little bit ahead of you and thought that might happen. So he called his own friends who were there that met you.
Jamie.
And then according to Adam, they all swarmed out with baseball bats and you got a gun and I don't even know.
That's, okay. Are you serious? In the middle, let me tell you, in the middle of Mount Berry Square movies.
Which is a good point. If guns and baseball bats were being slung around in a very public and popular movie theater parking lot, Why didn't anyone call the cops on it?
So, Susan, if this was never introduced at trial, the jury never got to hear it, why is it even important at this point?
I don't know exactly why Tammy Coulson ultimately decided not to bring it up at trial, but it's probably because, I mean, she got away with a lot. But I think this story would have shown the inherent ridiculousness of Chad and Adam's stories. Well, Chad's is closer to reality. He just has a gun being pulled and brandished around in an aggressive manner. But Adam's story involves like some massive like gang-on-gang baseball bat melee, which, no, that didn't happen. Of course that didn't happen. That's not a thing that would happen and no one would comment on or there'd be no evidence about. So I think I'm trying to understand how it could possibly be that all these witnesses would get up there and just make up stories to look at times when they did just that. Yes, it is very possible that Adam would go up in the stand and tell a story about how Joey did something he didn't really do, because he clearly did it here with this incident. I mean, even Chad's story, which just has the rifle being brandished, why didn't Brianne bring it up? I mean, she had an interview first, and she never mentioned this incident. So if she can't recall it, why was Chad suddenly able to, once Sutton had talked to Adam Elrod and heard the story from him?
Now, in addition to a couple stories that supposedly involved Joey brandishing shotguns or rifles, there were two prior transactions listed that involved Joey actually firing a firearm. Both of these supposedly involved Paul Allen, although Paul himself only remembers the first one. So with regard to that first incident, Colston's notice reads, "In 1996, Paul Allen and Will Ware were walking up Parkwood Circle, near where Joey Watkins lived with his family. Joey came out of the carport of his home with a rifle and shot at them."
I mentioned in an earlier episode that Paul had not recalled a thing about the shooting from the Panama City incident, which he was supposedly also at, but he had a crystal clear memory of this event. And while talking about the other events that Paul hadn't been able to remember, I asked him about the shooting, the one Paul had told me about.
What lies in particular do you think he told?
For one, the whole deal with, when I got locked up at Shea Highfield's house.
Yeah.
For one, Paul started that mess. Paul was in that car that night with Isaac.
If Isaac was really there, I'm not convinced he was there at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, I will say Paul is, for the most part, I found him to be seem fairly genuine, but his answer when I asked him about that was pretty weird. I don't believe that he did not remember what I was talking about.
Oh, he knows.
Yeah.
When they throw the firecrackers, they throw fireworks at us.
Yeah, he pretended he had no idea what that could have been.
I bet he didn't.
He did recall at a time that someone at your house shot outside in like 95.
What do you mean?
He said that he and like maybe Delane or someone, they went to your house after like calling you. And when they got to your house, someone fired out the door, like in the air or something.
Talking about Will Ware? I fired a gun in the air one time when Will Ware and Paul and all his little cousins came up there.
Oh, so Paul was there?
Yeah, Paul was there.
But you remember that one, and that was many years before this other stuff, and the rest of it I don't recall.
I was 13, 14, something like that.
I hadn't even met Brianne yet, probably.
Yeah, Brianne was not even a thought, man. That was nothing. That was about my sister.
What happened with her?
Will Ware wouldn't leave her alone. He kept harassing her. So I told him to leave her alone. He told me to mind my own business, and I punched him in the face. He pulled her hair on a bus and, making sexual comments at her. And it pissed me off pretty bad. So Will and I got to fighting, and Will got the best of me. And then, I was 5'5", 130 pounds. Will's like 6'1", 180, 6'1", 6'2". I was like seventh grade. And he kept messing with her. And that kept going on. So I fought him like three times. And he actually beat me up three times. So him and his cousins came up to the house one afternoon, and they were talking trash to my sister and Jenny. And they came in crying, so when all of them came to the house, I had a 22. I fired it in there, and all of them took off running.
So yeah, Paul and Joey both agree. There was an attempted confrontation at Joey's house. Joey got a rifle and shot it in the air. The boys coming to the house scattered. The end. And yet, Colston's notice says Joey actually fired at someone.
Now, the second shooting incident also involved Paul, and according to Colston's notice, in late 1999, Paul Allen and Roach were together. Delane Roach had been in an argument with Joey Watkins over the phone, and Joey told him to come to his house. Upon arrival at Joey Watkins' house, Delane Roach and Paul Allen got out of the car and were met with 4 shots from the carport. Joey Watkins told Adam Elrod that he pulled a gun on Delane Roach at his house.
Delane recalled this incident, although he was kind of surprised about the claim that supposedly Paul Allen had also been there.
Was there an incident where you and Paul Allen came up to Joey's house? Maybe 1996, 1997 time frame, and Joey fired a gun?
I don't know Paul that well, but I do recall this, but I don't think it had anything to do with Paul. I cannot say that it was Joey, but Joey was heated one night. He's very upset, and he did tell me, you know, don't come to my house. His parents even told me don't come up there. And I was like, you know, screw you and your parents. I'm coming up there, boy, and you're going to come outside. I don't remember. I can't say I wasn't with Paul because I saw him a couple of times, but, we weren't friends. But, yeah, I did pull up at Joey's, at Joey's house. Instead of pulling in the driveway, I pulled right to the front. And yes, I did hear a gunshot. But I can't say it was Joey. Would I speculate it was? Yeah. You know, but.
What? Why? To get you to leave?
Or? Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean.
Was it shot at you or?
No. I mean, their house is really close to the road, you know?
Uh-huh.
So yeah, it was Joey shooting. But the whole thing. I mean, nothing else about it matches the information in Colson's notice. Once again, Tammy Colston fell victim to one of the classic blunders. Don't rely on something Adam Elrod said just because it looks really good for your case. Yes, Adam's allegations against Joey were devastating, but Colston seems to have let that overshadow her common sense, which should have keyed her into the fact that they were also untrue.
The next incident on Colston's notice says, Paul Allen dated Breon Scarborough at one time, and during the time they dated, Joey Watkins continually threatened him. Now, no idea what Colston's talking about, because Paul and Breon certainly never dated.
Yeah, so here was Tammy Colston's initial proffer to the court about the testimony that was going to be presented. So the court asks, is Mr. Allen going to say why what Joey Watkins said to him? And Tammy Colston responds, uh-huh. The court then asks, what is he going to say? And Tammy Colston responds, it's pretty much just the same thing he said to everybody. And I look at Paul Allen's statement here. He would just follow people. Anybody who was dating Breanne, he would follow them around. But then a few moments later, apparently Colston realizes that she has made an error, and she amends her claim to say that Joey was also mad at Paul because he set Isaac and Breanne up. So she told the court, Joey threatened Paul because Paul was one of them that fixed up Isaac and Breanne. That was part of the reason he was mad at Paul. But Paul also dated Breanne at one time and said he was about 16 years old. There was a constant battle between he and Joey. Joey would call the house all the time, threatening to whip him or set his truck on fire.
But I am really skeptical of, well, all these claims, because Samantha seems to be the one who actually set up Isaac and Breanne, which, you know, makes a lot of sense. Also, Paul didn't really strike me as the kind of guy he'd be playing matchmaker. But I'm also pretty sure he never dated Breanne. I don't know where Colston got this claim from, but that's at least one line that's not on the relationship chart.
next incident is what we're going to call the Buffaloes incident. And here's what the proffer reads. In late 1998 or early 1999, Jeremy Schuler was dating Brianne Scarborough. Jeremy Schuler exited his car in front of Buffaloes restaurant in Rome, Georgia, and Joey Watkins pulled up. Joey Watkins threatened Jeremy Schuler with a knife for dating Brianne. Now, this story appeared out of nowhere. Brianne didn't mention it in any of her recorded statements, and none of Sutton's notes so much as hint that he'd learned about it. Because based on how excited he got over the most ridiculous, far-fetched rumors about Joey, he'd have been chasing this one down the moment he heard of it, if he ever learned of it. But in December 2000, almost a full year after the murder, Adam Elrod suddenly came up with a story about Joey pulling a knife out on a guy named Jeremy Schuler. Now, Jeremy had previously been something like friends with Joey, or at least buddies, although at trial, Jeremy ends up denying this and claiming Joey was just some guy he'd seen around town. But he was close friends with Adam. Best friends, if you believe Adam. And at one point, probably in 1998, he had dated Brianne. This, Jeremy told Stanley Sutton, led to an altercation with Joey, as he explained in a December 2000 interview when Sutton talked to him after Sutton had learned Adam's new story about it.
Tell me, in your own words, about what happened to you at an incident in Buffaloes.
I called Adam and asked him what he was eating at, and he said he was eating at Buffaloes with his uncle. So I was going to go up there with him and eat, and I noticed somebody followed me, and it was Joey in his car in that Charger. And so I pulled in Buffaloes, and they pulled up beside me, and I got out. And then just Joey got out, and I know there was two other guys in the car. And Joey started mouthing off about Brianne, mouthing off about what he was going to do because I was dating Brianne. And then he pulled a knife out of his pocket. I wasn't real sure if he opened it, but he pulled it. I know he pulled it out because he said, well, I'll just stab you right here. And I told him if he stabbed me, or I said, well, you come over here, and I'm going to stick that knife up your ass. So he put the knife back up, and then the other two guys got out of the car and said, come on, Joe, let's go. Let's don't bother to do nothing here or nothing. So they got back in the car and left, and as all this was going on, I seen Adam and his brother-in-law going down the turn of car, Shorter Avenue right there in front of Buffaloes, and I know they wasn't still in there, so I just got in the truck and left when they left and went to the house, and called Adam and told him what they did when I got my truck, and I was asking why he didn't come over there and, you know, with me, but He said I wasn't gonna get in the middle of it, and that's why it's hard. And then that's all that happened that day.
And Sutton is careful to clarify this is all over Brianne.
Why was he having a dislike for you?
Well, when he broke up with Brianne, me and him were still buddies, and I said, you know, and it was a couple months after they stopped talking. I said, well, Brianne got one of her buddies asked me if I'd want to go out and eat with her. So, and I asked Joey, I said, you think that'd be out? Because me and Joey and Adam and Todd and all used to hang out. And he said, yeah, that's cool, man. He said, I'm through with her. And I said, well, all right, you don't go out and eat. And then the next thing I know, he's all pissed off at me and pissed off at Adam because I don't know why he was mad at Adam.
And during the time at the Buffalo incident, he brought up about Brianne.
Yeah. I don't remember really what he said. But I know that was what it was all about, because he said, you know, I thought you was my buddy and I thought you this, and I told him, I said, well, you know, I asked you if it would bother you, you know, and you said no, you said you're through with it. You know, it's just young kid stuff.
By the time of the trial, though, Jeremy's story had undergone a dramatic change. It wasn't just that Joey threatened to stab him, he said. In fact, he'd been on the phone with Brianne through the whole exchange, and she heard the threat, too.
Yeah, so here's Jeremy testifying at trial. Question, okay, and did you have a, what were you doing when you pulled into the parking lot at Buffalo's? Answer, I was on the phone with Brianne. Question, you were on the phone with Brianne? Answer, uh-huh. Question, and when you were talking to Brianne, what happened? Answer, well, I got out of the truck and I was still on the phone with her, and then when I got out, Joey was standing there. Question, okay, so when Joey got out of the car, what did he do? Answer, he had his hands in his pocket, so I sat the phone down in the seat while I told Brianne to hold on and sat the phone down in the seat, and he said, what are you doing, dating her? I thought me and you was buddies. He said, I ought to just cut you up. And I told him, I said, if you think you can stand it, just do it, you know? Question, okay, I ought to just cut you up. What did he have in his hand? Answer, a knife.
Tammy has a bad habit of testifying for her witnesses. And Joey's attorneys had a terrible habit of letting her get away with it. Because notice how, in that exchange, Jeremy hadn't even mentioned being able to see Joey's hands at all, let alone see any kind of knife. And yet, Colston jumped right in to prompt him. What did he have in his hand? Oh, a knife, Jeremy responds. Although, the question before, he says that Joey's hands are still in his pockets. Colston continued this style of testa-questioning with Brianne, who, remarkably, also suddenly recalled the same event, despite never mentioning it before in any interview she'd given previously.
Here's what Brianne testified to. Question, do you recall the incident where you were on the phone with Jeremy and Jeremy pulled up to eat dinner at Buffalo's restaurant? Answer, yes, ma'am. Question, can you tell me what you heard, what you know? Were you on the phone with Jeremy? Answer, yes, ma'am. Question, okay, what did you hear? Answer, he had said that Joey was there. He told me to hold on for a minute because there seemed to be a ruckus. So he laid the phone down in the seat and I could kind of hear what was going on. I heard something about a knife. And then Jeremy said, well, if you pull it out, you had better use it. That's all I heard. Question, okay, that is all you heard? Answer, the rest was mumbling. Question, okay, could you hear Joey mumbling in the background? Answer, most definitely.
I start twitching just hearing or reading these exchanges because, like, how is Joey's attorney not just, like, standing up every 3 seconds, like, objection leading, objection leading?
It's leading, it's hearsay, there's authentication questions. I mean, there's a multitude of reasons why you could and should object. And it, beyond the fact that, going back to what we initially said, these are not incidents of modus operandi. These are not things that establish that the murder of Isaac Dawkins by shooting him on Highway 27 couldn't have been committed by anybody else. They're incidents of debatable reliability that at most tangentially might tend to prove violent tendencies by Joey, but they're not any type of common plan or scheme that establishes an MO.
So let's ignore for a moment that Brianne never remembered this event until the trial, and that Jeremy's initial plea statement didn't mention a thing about being on the phone with Brianne, because memory lapses do happen. But there's still one very big problem with this whole story, and that's Adam Elrod. Because Adam talked about the Buffalo's incident too, and once again, Adam's stories come back to haunt Tammy Colston. Or well, it should have, if the defense had thought to bring it up at trial. This is Adam's December interview with Sutton, or at least a few portions of that interview. Adam's statements are the absolute worst to try and present on the podcast, unless you end up editing 90% of what he says, because otherwise this episode would go on forever. For instance, when you ask Adam about that time Joey threatened to stab Jeremy, you end up with a 3-minute answer about what kind of trucks his uncle liked to drive, why those trucks excited Adam, who Adam's favorite country singer is, how he won a karaoke contest singing Tracy Lauren songs, how his married uncle loves to flirt with ladies, and how he and his uncle were both too drunk to drive, but he agreed to drive anyway because he knew his uncle wouldn't let anything happen to him. And this is all before Adam gets around to mentioning how Jeremy fits into the story. So for the full effect of what kind of witness Adam is, I would encourage you to go read the transcripts. As presented here, it probably sounds misleadingly coherent, but here's what he eventually stammers out.
Well, after then, I was supposed to leave Buffalo's with Jeremy. I'd forgot all about Jeremy being out there in the parking lot. Well, I called him on the car phone before I walked out of Buffalo's. He said, somebody's out here, they want to talk to you. And this is when me and Joey wasn't getting along. And I knew who was out there. I knew who was out there because, I mean, I walked over to the door and I looked out and I seen that red Charger sitting there and all them boys standing out there. You know, I don't know if Jeremy got mad, but I didn't go out there. And I talked to Jeremy on my car phone. I told him, I said, man, I said, I can't come out there. I said, I do. I said, Uncle Robbie's going to go to prison. I said, he's drinking.
Was Jeremy outside in the parking lot?
Yeah. He said, Jeremy told me, he said, right when I pulled up, he said, Joey had been behind me since I was coming across town, racing his motor up, swerving at me. He said, he pulled me up. I pulled over at Buffalo's. He pulled over right there and jumped out. And Jeremy said, I jumped out of the truck and walked up to him. Said, Joey pushed me. He said, I pushed Joey down. Joey got back up and pulled his little black Gerber out and said, I'll cut your effing guts out.
Now, that's when Joey had pulled a knife on Jeremy.
Yeah. Said, I'll cut your effing guts out.
Yeah. So according to Jeremy, or at least the trial version of Jeremy, he was on the phone with Brianne throughout the entire encounter. But Adam says he called Jeremy in the middle of the whole altercation, and Jeremy told him to come outside, because Joey wants to talk to him. But how was he on the phone with Brianne and Adam while dealing with a guy threatening to stab him with a knife, all the while the phone is inside his car in the car seat, while he's outside? And never mind the rest of Adam's story. It's all over the place, too.
I called Jeremy earlier this year, trying to figure out what was going on with the whole Buffalo's incident. Brianne and Adam didn't want to talk to us, which left him as the only non-Joey witness to the whole event. I mean, yeah, we knew Joey's version of the story, that there had been a fight, but there hadn't been a knife, and it had nothing to do with Brianne, but was instead an argument he'd had with Adam that Jeremy had appeared at and broken up. But that's Joey's version, and he's a convicted murderer, and from a legal standpoint, his memories, well, let's just say I don't see a court of law taking them very seriously. Which means we need someone other than Joey to recall what happened here. So we were really grateful when Jeremy agreed to talk to us on the phone. But he apologized at the start. He didn't know how much he could help us. Because he remembered Joey, and remembered that he stopped being friends with Joey because Joey, quote, wasn't a good person. And he had a very clear memory of this one time when Joey had called him to threaten him, and Jeremy told him to go ahead and come to his house, but Joey never showed up. But that's kind of all he remembers. That incident, he said, was probably about Brianne. And when we read him his trial testimony, where he talked about the whole Buffalo's incident thing, he sounded vaguely puzzled and not at all convinced that we weren't just making this all up for some unknown reason. I don't remember any of that, he said. If that happened, I'd probably remember that, I think. Finally, he offered up, well, there was one time he could remember having a face-to-face confrontation with Joey, but he was pretty sure that was the only time something like that had ever occurred, and that couldn't be what we were asking him about, because that had something to do with Adam. It wasn't directed towards Jeremy at all, he said, because that was way before he'd ever started talking to Brianne, and he was pretty sure that Joey didn't even know who he was at that point. But there wasn't a knife, no blows had actually been exchanged. But while he couldn't remember the details of it, Jeremy did remember the cause of the confrontation was something to do with Adam pissing off Joey. After we hung up on the phone with Jeremy, Claire and I were left even more confused than we had been before.
Why would Jeremy Schuller not recall the knife incident, but did kind of sort of recall the threat at his house?
I think the knife incident might not have happened.
Did he tell a lie at trial and has forgotten that he told a lie at trial?
Did he tell that lie at trial? I wasn't quoting the trial transcript.
Yeah, he said he was on the phone with Brianne when it happened.
I mean, it could be that he forgot, but it seems strange to me that you would remember something insignificant compared to something very potentially significant.
And here's one more thing. There's only one other place in this whole case that a knife has ever been mentioned. And that's from Delane Roach, who told Claire when she spoke to him this year that there was one time he'd had a confrontation with Joey in a parking lot, and he'd pulled a knife on Joey, although he'd accidentally dropped it. Now, Delane and Jeremy had been close friends back then, so I kind of wonder, is it possible that Jeremy had borrowed this whole knife story from Delane, but has now forgotten that he did so? So yeah, there are, what, three or four more events listed on Colston's notice, but they're all in the same vein. They're all really far disconnected from anything to do with this murder. And some of them are like from 1995. Some involve disputes about Brianne dating guys that she definitely never dated. I mean, Adam, to be fair to Colston, he did claim that he went on a date with Brianne and that's why Joey was pissed, but like I am 99.9% certain that one didn't happen. So we'll spare you all that. There are a couple involving Joey's girlfriends after Brianne, Aslan Hogue and Kelly Robinson, which we'll get to in a later episode. But there are two more events that are worth noting.
Both of these incidents involve a guy named Ronald Vines, or Buddy Vines as most people knew him. Now, neither of these incidents ever came up at Joey's trial, and that's for a lot of reasons. In fact, Buddy Vines himself failed to make an appearance at trial, even though he testified at Joey's bond hearing. That said, he was a big part of Stanley Sutton's investigation, a lead that Sutton hoped would pan out. And to explain what's going on in these prior transactions, we need to go all the way back to the start of the bad blood between Joey and Buddy. Now, so far you may have gotten the impression that the people in this case were fighting all the time, that it was basically part of their daily routine. They certainly talked about fighting often enough, but that impression, according to a lot of people, may be misleading. Here's Tandy, Joey's sister, again talking about the fight she could remember.
The funny thing is, like, hardly anybody ever fought. Like, all of these stories with all these people just hating each other and bickering and all this, like, literally hardly ever did anybody ever swing on each other. Everybody ran their mouth, and it was really that's usually what it came to.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, I don't remember a whole lot of actual fighting going on back then.
The only ones I've seen is basically Buddy Vines and Joe.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Now, they were like a gang, okay? And they legit pulled up in my driveway one day and beat the crap out of Chad. I mean, they beat him with a ball bat. And I was not allowed, my parents would not let me go anywhere by myself.
Now, the whole dispute between Joey and Buddy Vines began trivially enough. Joey and Paul were in a car together when Buddy and a few of his friends rolled by. At that point, Paul started mocking them through the windows, pissing them off, and from there, things escalated further.
Like two or three days later, they found out who Paul was. They didn't call me and mess with me, so they were picking on Paul. So Paul was supposed to fight him, so they actually came to Paul's house at Dempsey Dairy. And Paul called me, man, come down here. They're coming to jump on me, blah, blah, blah. Tony and Chris ain't here. I was like, all right. So I show up. When I show up, they leave. Well, that started the whole thing between me and Buddy Vines and this whole 501 clique that they were in. That was the gang, the little 501 boys, they called themselves. They left when I pulled up. So, like, a week later, after that, this was like an ongoing thing. They find out that Chad dated my sister at the time. So they start messing with Chad. So they catch Chad coming to my house, and they whip Chad's ass in my driveway. Beat Chad pretty bad. So on my way home, I was in my dad's Firebird. They were peeling out of the neighborhood when I came home. Well, when I pull up, I see blood all over the concrete. I'm like, what the hell? So there's blood in the carport. So I come running in the house, and my sister's screaming. So I looked at her, and she's all right. And then I see Chad with this towel on his face, and he's pouring blood. He got the shit beat out of him. So I jumped back in the car, and I met him at the bypass. And they were in some fat kid that was in the little gang with them. They were in an Explorer. I tried to get them to pull over. I was like, man, pull over. And they wouldn't pull. I was by myself. There's like five of them.
When I first heard Joey say this, I thought it might be a little like what Delaine was saying about how in these stories, the number of assailants the teller of the story had faced always tends to creep upwards. But then I was rereading Buddy Vine's testimony from the bond hearing. He was brought on as evidence that Joey was a threat to witnesses' lives and therefore shouldn't be granted bond. And Buddy's testimony suggests that there actually might have been as many as seven people in the total that night who were there beating up Chad.
Yeah, so here's Buddy testifying at Joey's bond hearing. Question, how many were with you and Gary Highfield when you went over to Joey's house and started this fight? Answer, maybe five people.
The feud with Buddy didn't end there. About 3 months later, in May of 99, Joey ran into Buddy Vines again. This time at the mall.
I had a stomach virus, and I had been throwing up for like 2 days. And I was just getting over it, so Brianne calls me up, and Brianne's like, you going to come get me? And I'm like, you didn't drive to work? She's like, She's like, yeah, just come get me. I'm like, what's up? She wouldn't tell me. So when I get to the mall, I see Dustin Pate, Buddy Vines, and a bunch of guys standing out in the food court. So when I pull up, I was kind of weak. I didn't even have on shoes. I had on a pair of sandals. So when I pull up, they're all flipping me off when I get out. So I was like, okay, check this out. So I got back in my S10. I went to Mark's house, got Mark. And I'm like, look, man, these dudes, I got to go get Brianne. These dudes are starting this bullshit. And Mark was like, shit, let's go. So Mark was always down for that. So we go back to the mall and we get out. So I had on a pair of sandals. Like, you know, we called them Jesus sandals. We get out and we go to walking in. Well, Buddy starts talking trash. So I looked at Buddy. I was like, look, dude, I'm not supposed to fight you right now. He was like, yeah, you ain't going to fight me because you're a bitch and blah, blah, blah. And he said all these other things, you know. So Mark was like, you know what? You want to fight? Let's fight. So him and Mark square off. So when they squared off with one another, I'm like, shit, I can't let Mark fight my fight. So I swung at Buddy. Well, me and Buddy get the fight and whatever, whatnot. And I didn't notice it, but he had something in his hand. And at the end of the fight, I can't remember the whole fight. But anyway, he ends up breaking my nose with whatever he had in his hand. And that was the whole extent with me and Buddy. But that whole situation started because of Paul.
Now, as a result of this fight, Buddy Vines pled guilty to aggravated assault, and he was ordered to pay restitution to Joey. So basically, that's the backstory. And with that in place, let's get back to the two so-called similar transactions on Colston's list, both of which supposedly occurred after Isaac's death. According to the first one, on August 25th, 2000, in the evening hours, Joey Watkins positioned his fingers like a gun and pointed it at Ronald Vines. Joey was with five or more other men. Joey Watkins made a shooting gesture and said he was going to kill him that night when he got home. 911 was called. Joey was mad at Ronald Vines over Ronald being with a woman that Joey was jealous of. Now, this event was in August 2000, so 7 months after Isaac's death. As a result, Buddy Vines, after the incident, filed a police report claiming he'd had a run-in with Joey while they were both out in the town on a Friday night. According to Buddy, Joey had been in a car with five of his friends, and Buddy had been with just one friend, Dustin Pate. According to the incident report,
the complainant stated that a Joey Watkins pulled alongside of them on Turner McCall and Hicks Drive in a black Grand Prix and motioned like he had a gun, and said to complainant that he was going to kill him and he would get him tonight. Warrants were advised.
Buddy, however, never did take out any warrants, and that was really kind of it. He told Sutton that his friend Dustin Pate also witnessed the incident, but Sutton never attempted to verify it. And although Sutton did tape an interview with Buddy, that taped interview did not include several interesting things that Sutton's pre-interview notes showed. Namely that, according to Buddy, the friends accompanying Joey on the night he supposedly threatened to kill Buddy included Adam Elrod and Paul Allen. Now, neither Paul Allen nor Adam Elrod have ever mentioned this incident to anyone, and the prosecutor and detectives never asked them if what Buddy said was claiming was in fact true. Nonetheless, despite this story coming from a suspect source and making zero attempt to verify it with two other state's witnesses who were supposedly there, Colston still included it in her notice of prior transactions. She also added a line about how, quote, Joey was mad at Ronald Vines over Ronald being with a woman that Joey was jealous of, which has no evidentiary source whatsoever, whether questionable or otherwise.
They say there's only three things that are certain in this life: death, taxes, and the fact that going to the post office takes up valuable time. Well, they might not say that third one, but doesn't make it any less true. It's also true that leasing a postage meter can be expensive and come with multi-year contracts and hidden fees. Fortunately for you, dear undisclosed listener, we have a better way, and that better way is Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official postage for any letter or package right from your desk, using your own computer and printer, and even get special postage discounts that you cannot find at the post office. Oh wait, it gets better. Stamps.com is even more powerful than a postage meter. At just a fraction of the cost, check this, you can save up to 50% compared to a postage meter. And you'll save invaluable time by not going to the post office. Literally, your time is invaluable. So let me tell you how to save that money and save that time right now. Go to stamps.com and use the promo code undisclosed. You're going to get a special offer, which will include a 4-week trial of stamps.com and a $110 bonus offer, which includes postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type undisclosed. That's stamps.com. Enter undisclosed.
Other Buddy Vine's transaction was this. In January or February of 2000, Joey Watkins and Mark Free pulled Mark Kent and Ronald Vines over in their car on Dean Street in Rome, Georgia. When Mr. Vines and Mr. Kent stopped, Joey Watkins and Mark Free jumped out of their car with a shotgun and pointed it at Mr. Vines and Mr. Kent. This argument was over a female. Once again, where on earth does Colson's claim come from when she writes this argument was over a female? Because females had nothing at all to do with Joey and Buddy's dispute. Colson has the rest of the facts wrong, too, about what Buddy claims happened. This is how Buddy testified at the bond hearing. Question: was there a time that somebody jumped out of a car with a gun? Answer: yes, ma'am, Joey, and I don't know who the other guy was, but they jumped out with a shotgun. Question: when was that? Answer: it's been close to, it was before the mall, before the incident at the mall. But Buddy knew who Mark Free was, and he doesn't identify Mark as the guy with Joey that night. So why does Colson claim that it's Mark? And the incident in the mall was in May 1999, so why does Colson claim it was 7 or 8 months later, around the same time as Isaac's murder? In fact, just a few weeks ago, a Floyd County Police Department officer named Chris Shelley was using stories about the ongoing dispute between Joey and Buddy to convince our listeners, undisclosed listeners, that Joey was in fact guilty of Isaac's murder. He started by posting claims on the undisclosed Facebook page about how Joey was a bully that attacked people with golf clubs, and here's what he wrote. Perhaps his, meaning Joey's, gang of thugs he ran with can testify for him, or the guy he beat with a golf club. Look at his record. Look at what he wasn't charged with because the victims never pressed charges. I have no doubt that he did it. I was around and had firsthand knowledge of his criminal activities. None of that is true, by the way. Well, it's true that Chris Shelley was and is an officer with Floyd County Police Department, but Joey never beat anyone with a golf club, and Shelley's knowledge of Joey's so-called criminal activities turns out to say a lot more about him than it does about Joey. Because Officer Shelley also decided to private message an undisclosed listener and convince her of Joey's guilt. Here's what he wrote. I don't put much of my personal life on Facebook. I have been an officer with the Floyd County Police Department for 26 years. Joey Watkins was both a bully and a coward. He liked to attack his victims as part of a group usually. He stalked Dawkins for weeks. We were just never able to catch him in the act. Remember, he was convicted by a jury. I was an officer at the time of this case. Watkins followed Dawkins home several times. We had several reports of it, but we're unable to catch him. I had several encounters with Watkins and his victims, including one arrest of Watkins. This was not a sudden incident. There was a long history of harassment of Dawkins by Watkins. The harassment was after the breakup. Watkins was obsessed. Dawkins' family was upset that Watkins was following Dawkins and we didn't catch him. The family witnessed the stalking. This was before we had temporary protective orders. The listener wrote back, so you are telling me that the family on several occasions saw Joey stalk their son with their own eyes? The officer responds, yes. They would call when Dawkins was followed home. He lived in a very rural area of the county. The usual night shift for the county was four officers. I wish I could remember who Watkins ran with.
Hey, Joey.
Hey.
So, real briefly, I have a few things to go over with you that I didn't get last time. Did Claire tell you anything about the Facebook messages that were being sent?
I don't think so.
So one of the listeners of the podcast reached out to me, and she had some questions about some of the evidence in the case, and said that a Floyd County officer had messaged her on Facebook and said some stuff that we hadn't talked about, and she was like, well, this would affect my decision as a juror. I want to know more about it if you're not putting it in the show. So I was like, okay, what's he telling you? And she sends it over, and it's a guy named Chris Shelley.
Yeah.
That rings a bell.
You know him?
No, I have no clue. I think this is the whole thing about golf club. Ain't
golf
that what
club
my
guy.
Yeah, that's yeah, my dad was saying something about that a while back.
He was messaging about that too, but this was a private message to one listener in particular, and he wrote to her and said, I have been an officer with the Floyd County Police Department for 26 years. Joey Watkins was both a bully and a coward. He liked to attack his victims as part of a group, usually. He stalked Dawkins for weeks. We were just never able to catch him in the act. Remember,
Watkins
he was convicted
troubled.
By a jury. The harassment was after the breakup. Watkins was obsessed. And she asks him, wait, there were witnesses that saw him chasing Dawkins? And he says, chasing Dawkins? No, but there were witnesses who observed the pattern of stalking. His family was upset that Watkins was following Dawkins and we didn't catch him. The family witnessed the stalking. The family would call when Dawkins was followed home. He lived in a very rural area of the county.
I have no clue who this dude is or what he's talking about.
Well, he did arrest you once, actually.
He arrested me?
It looks like it. I have one report here from February 24th, 99. And it was arrest for disorderly conduct.
And February 24th.
It says, and it's Chris Shelley, officer 1539, and it says, while on routine patrol, this reporting officer observed the above-listed subject standing in the parking lot of the Golden Gallon holding a large metal pipe. The accused was yelling at three other subjects across the parking lot. Mr. Watkins was arrested without incident. Mr. Redden was standing beside the open passenger door of Mr. Watkins' vehicle during this. Mr. Watkins stated that the three subjects had earlier followed him and his sister, threatening harassing them.
Man, that's Buddy Vines.
Yeah, Mr. Redden is recovering from injuries he says he received when two of the three assaulted him. Mr. Watkins and Mr. Redden states that these three have threatened to harm them if they testify against the three in court. The other three are as follows. Cody Poe, Gary Highfield, Ronald Vines.
That's Buddy Vines, Ronald Vines. He's the one that broke my nose at the mall.
Anyway, yeah, it's true that Officer Shelley did in fact have an encounter with Joey. But it makes Shelley's claim about Joey being a bully and a coward who attacked in groups seem a little bit suspect.
I remember the incident. My sister and Chad were going to Chad's house, and my sister called me, and she was like, look, I want you to come follow me home because Buddy Vines and some other guys were follow them to Chad's house. They started following them on Maple Road or something. I can't remember. But when I went to Chad's house to follow her home, they started following me. So when I got to Chad's house, they kept riding by. And Chad was like, let's just ride and call the cops and let's ride to the Golden Gallon. And I was like, okay. So his mom and I think my sister actually called the cops first. So when we pulled out, they followed us and we went to the gas station. So when we got to the gas station, then the cops pulled up. And when the cops pulled up, I mean, I'm not going to let these, Chad, they had just beat the crap out of Chad. They'd hurt Chad pretty bad. So I'm not just going to let them jump on me. It wasn't a pipe. It was a ball bat. I mean, I'm not going to lie about the whole situation. I'm not going to let three guys jump on me after I've already called the cops, you know?
So you called the cops?
They thought,
and when
the yes,
cops
we called
the
cops. Right. What happened was when I left Chad's house, I was in my sister's car. She had a Neon, a 96 Neon, a purple Neon. And I guess they thought it was my sister and Chad. So when we went down to, they called the cops. My sister and Chad's mom called the cops first and said, look, we got a problem. They're trying to follow us or whatever. They just went to the, and I think they told the cops that I was going to the Golden Gallon.
What was the part about them threatening to harm you and Chad if they testify against the three in court?
Yeah, see, they threatened to hurt me and Chad if I testified that they had jumped on Chad in my driveway.
So yeah, that's Officer Shelley's proof that Joey was a bully and a coward. A group of five or more guys came to Joey's house to attack him, and when they found his sister's boyfriend there instead, they jumped him, pulled him out of his truck, and beat him up so bad he needed to go to the hospital. Then, a few months later, when those same guys were upset that Joey and Chad might testify against them because of the whole assault, they continued to harass Joey and Chad and Joey's sister, to the point they called the police for help. Which makes me kind of wonder if Officer Shelley's memory has gotten mixed up over the years. And that it's actually Buddy Vines he's thinking of when he's describing Joey, and not Joey Watkins. But on the other hand, this pattern of spreading false and severely defamatory rumors about Joey being a violent thug is straight out of the SCPD playbook. It's what Stanley Sutton did back then, and Officer Shelley is continuing that pattern now, only addressing an online audience instead of the Rome rumor network.
I have to be honest, this episode was hard for me. It made me fume and fidget. Dredging up and totally making up petty teen arguments as evidence in a Murder One case is what I call irredeemable prosecutorial practice. And it looks like, given what the police officer who reached out to our listener is trying to do, that the state is still trying to convince people that Joey's just generally a bad person, spreading their own rumors. So why stoop so low? Why get so desperate? Probably because when you take a close look at the forensic and ballistic evidence in the case, there's not much else you can do. Next time on Undisclosed.
What's up, Undisclosed Season 2, Episode 11. Folks, I got a couple of goodies for you this week before I roll into the credits. First up, our fabulous producer, Rebecca Lavoie, has just launched a brand new podcast, and it is wonderful. It's called These Are Their Stories, the Law & Order podcast. Rebecca and her husband, true life crime author Kevin Flynn, delve into the backstories behind some of your favorite Law & Order episodes. Their second episode debuts Wednesday, and check it out, the host of your Undisclosed Addendum, John Cryer, is going to be on this Wednesday's episode of These Are Their Stories.
I thought we lost him for a second.
And musical theater,
but I also love the
genius
breakdown. I love the you know, come on. The opening theme song, it luxuriates in itself. It just goes on, and it has these wonderful photo montage of, you know, New York crime sort of moments. You know, it's a 14-hour miniseries of photos.
It was all this valuable network time that got wasted.
Yes, yeah. They could have been showing commercials at that time.
I think eventually they did.
Yes.
These Are Their Stories, the Law & Order podcast. Give it a listen. It's a lot of fun. I really enjoyed the first episode, and I know that you're going to enjoy the second. Number two on our things to give you list is information about an award that one of our great listeners has nominated Susan for. That's right, Susan is an alumnus of the Agnes Scott College. And every year, the Agnes Scott Alumni Association recognizes outstanding alumni in four categories. Our listener, LC, brought this to our attention, and she even organized a campaign to try to get Susan nominated for this award. She's asking our listeners to send her emails about how Susan has been a positive influence in your life through Undisclosed. Whether that's because you admire her tireless work in Adnan's case, the outstanding depth of her research in Joey's case, or maybe you just dig her witty exchanges on Twitter. Either way, Susan's great. We all know it. We want to make sure she gets nominated for this award. So if you could send Elle an email, the address is nominatesusan@gmail.com. Send Elle a letter of support. She will include it in the packet. If you've got a personal story about Susan, feel free to send that in as well. Every little email helps, Elle says. So please, again, send that email to nominatesusan@gmail.com. And with your goodies done, let's roll into the credits.
As always, we want to thank the Georgia Innocence Project for bringing us Joey's case and working tirelessly for dozens of possibly wrongfully convicted defendants down in Georgia. Send them some love. Every little dollar counts. You can do so at www.georgiainnocenceproject.org. Our sponsors keep this show's boat afloat. This week, those include ABC's debuting drama, Conviction. Hey, it comes out Monday, October 2nd. We watched an advance copy. We loved it. We think you will too. So check it out. Stamps.com. They've been a friend of the show for so long, and we truly appreciate it. Thanks, Stamps. And our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. Hey, I switched over from 3 to 4 meals a week with Blue Apron, so I expect to tweet out more pictures soon. The people that make this show great include Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories, the Law & Order podcast. Check both of them out. They're wonderful. She gets help from Hannah McCarthy and Brooke Giddings of the Actual Innocence podcast. Theme music brought to you by Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez. Our logo was designed by Baluki. Holy crap, I actually had an exchange with Baluki this week for the first time. It was marvelous. Baluki's going to help us out with a couple people maps as well, so make sure you check those out at www.undisclosed-podcast.com. There you can also check out the case docs and marvel at the fabulous web design done by Nina Mooser and Christy Williams. Beyond our website, you can get at us at the social medias. Social medias. I'm going to keep saying social medias because it amuses me. Our handle is at Undisclosed Pod. We're on the Twitters, the Facebooks, the Instagrams. Send us your tweets. We'll do our best to respond. And don't forget, you can ask our amazing Undisclosed Addendum host, John Cryer, a question by tweeting at him with the hashtag UDAddendum. Send him a question and maybe he'll ask it on the show. Lastly and leastly, your executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to...
He's had that Grand Prix for over a year. And it was cold too then.
Okay.
Because I had a sweatshirt on that night and had my duck boots on.
Had you ever seen Joey Watkins threatened, well, you told me that he threatened Jeremy Shuler one night. And well, tell me about that.
We was at Buffalo's one night, or me and my Uncle Robbie. We like to sing karaoke at Buffalo's. It happens on Wednesday nights, or I don't know if it does now, but it used to. I was young then. I was 19 or 20. I can't really remember. I think I was 19. My uncle, he had a black F-250, and I always liked to drive it because I'd never drove a diesel truck like that before, and it excited me. Well, he let me off in it that night, and I come back to Buffalo's, and we sang, our favorite singer's always been Tracy Lawrence. We sang up there that night, and me and him won it. Well, after then, I was supposed to leave Buffalo's with Jeremy. Well, my Uncle Rob, he's married, but he does a lot of flirting. Well, he said, we're going to go out on the town. And I had been up there, and he had bought me drinks, and I drank. I'd had about over my limit. Well, he said he couldn't drive, and I told him, well, I'd go ahead and drive, you know. I said, since you're with me, I said, you won't let nothing happen to you. Well, I forgot all about Jeremy being out there in the parking lot. Well, I called him on the car phone before I walked out of Buffalo's. He said, somebody's out here, they want to talk to you. And this is when me and Joey wasn't getting along, and I knew who was out there. I knew who was out there because, I mean, I walked over to the door, and I looked out, and I seen that red Charger sitting there and all them boys standing out there. And, you know, I don't know if Jeremy got mad, but I didn't go out there. I'd had too much to drink, and if I'd have went out there, my Uncle Robbie would have went out there, and it wouldn't have been nothing but a fight, and we'd all went to jail. Because he's not the one for somebody to threaten a part of his family. That's a no-no. And it don't matter who it is. He don't care who they are. You threaten his family, you're going to be one hurt person. And I talked to Jeremy on my car phone. I told him, I said, man.